Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Dominic Fifield of The Athletic. In baseball, they call the regular season, which consists of 162 games, the grind. Our footballers know what they're talking about. This weekend sees the start of 8 rounds of Premier League matches in 6 weeks, not to mention 3 more rounds of European games and League Cup ties. The overload is now undeniable and complicated by unique circumstances. This season is a slog, a marathon with 6 or 7 serious contenders. Injuries and infections are the last things managers need. But at the moment, it's all they seem to get. Let's get down to brass tacks, Migs. Could this ruin Liverpool's defence of the title?
I'm not sure if ruin. I actually still, after everything, would have them as favourites. But it could severely hobble it, make it that much more difficult, and give them a lot more to navigate. I mean, obviously now Klopp has a lot to figure out in how he structures the team because he's been missing so many players. They've probably got a bit more to think about in January. And yeah, it just makes everything that bit more complicated.
As we've mentioned, the demands of the season are going to be unique, Dom. Do you think the misfortune will even itself out over time?
Yes, I suppose it's going to be tougher, you could say, for those clubs competing in Europe because they will have more workload, inevitably. But then they also probably boast the greater depth in quality in terms of their squads, so it probably evens itself out in that respect. And I'm guessing that this conversation will soon veer towards 5 substitutions and the like. And it should be noted pretty early on, probably, that Manchester City and Liverpool hardly used their allocation of 3 subs in their fixture prior to this international break. That will probably taint my argument on that one. Yeah, we all knew that this season was going to be the hardest ever. I spoke with sports scientists and medics at football clubs prior to the season, actually concentrating largely on the EFL clubs, because I think the demands placed on those guys is probably even greater than those in the Premier League. I mean, they have 46 standard league games plus domestic cup competitions to cram into their schedule, and it was considerably shorter length of time in which to fulfil those fixtures. And there was a realism and a pragmatism in their approach. They knew that the soft tissue injuries would stack up. They also knew there would be a greater reliance upon their under-23s, you know, that you probably wouldn't loan quite as many players to teams in lower divisions because you're going to be relying upon them, even if not in the first team, then certainly in training, to try and keep levels up amongst those players who aren't in recovery sessions, those unused substitutes, those squad members that aren't getting regular game time, because you need those guys to be fresh to step in when people are dropping like flies from the regular 11. So none of this is unexpected. This is exactly what the sports scientists and the medical departments were saying was going to happen. It's highlighted because it's now happening to high-profile Premier League clubs and the defending champions, etc. And yes, you know, what happened to them over this international window with Joe Gomez and Jordan Henderson is really, really bad news, but it's affecting everybody up and down the pyramid.
What about the politics, Migs, of club against country you know, it's not as easy as managers insisting on players withdrawing, is it?
No, because they can't do that. I mean, you need. I mean, I wrote this week, heard one story about one high-profile manager who fell out with one of his stars because he tried to insist he pull out, but the agent basically pleaded with him, saying that you can't actually pull out. It's not like the Ferguson days, because the regulations have since changed, where the international medical team get the final say. So there has to be a genuine injury there. There can't be frivolous pullouts anymore. Of course, those politics have been exacerbated by the extreme nature of the windows. And I mean, we've really never seen breaks like this. In a usual season, it always feels a little bit overkill that there's three international breaks in such quick succession over September, October, November. But of course, this break has had three games in the last two, and that was due to the June internationals being called off and a bit of horse trading between the federations and the clubs over the movement of Euro 2020. But I think for all we talk about the loan and the situation and the stress on players, I think the key to this whole debate, really, what it comes down to is big footballs, if you like, its insistence on playing absolutely every single match and having a normal season in the most abnormal circumstances, and when at least 2 months have been cut off the season. I mean, I do find it remarkable that there wasn't more compromise somewhere. I mean, what I'm just trying to think of changes that have actually been made to the calendar in that regard. You know, one
it's just
is
FA Cup replays.
That's
isn't it. Really?
And League Cup semi-finals, where they're one leg other than two leg. I think that's pretty much it. And I mean, when you stand back, that is real. Like, there could have been a bit more give somewhere, given the situation we're in.
I should add to that. We've had international managers come out and say that this is too much in the last couple of weeks. Why are we playing three internationals in that time, in that period? Why were England? Why did they have the Ireland friendly? Why was that necessary? Why did they have the Wales friendly in the previous window? England have played as many games this season as the Premier League clubs. They've played 8 fixtures this season. The Premier League clubs have only played 8 fixtures this season at most. It's insane. So for international managers to come out and say, oh, something's got to be done, the clubs have got to manage this better. Well, actually, you had an opportunity there where you could have just taken a bit of training time as opposed to playing a pointless friendly that was just risking further damage to players. And maybe everybody has to compromise, and that includes the likes of UEFA and national associations as well as domestic leagues.
Because the situation is being complicated further by COVID, isn't it? You look at Mo Salah as an example. You know, another positive test reported by the Egyptian FA. Looks like he might even be struggling for Brighton on Saturday week. How worried, Migs, should football be with the rising cases? I know it was reported 16 positives in the Premier League in the last week.
Yeah, I mean, and it was one of the things that struck even over the last 2 months with rising cases in society, that the Premier League actually stayed really constant and they were extremely low. And I mean, 16, you would still, relatively speaking, is low, but in comparison to what the Premier League had before, it does represent a spike. And we have the tests now after this international break to come. And this international break, beyond the injuries, has just been a farce. Well, I think it was, 3 games postponed in the end? I mean, one of the reasons we're playing these games is the insistence on fulfilling contracts and the kind of almost the pedantry of getting the Nations League done. But then you have the chaos where, you know, 3 of the games have to be decided by postponement and by awarding 3-0 wins. And I mean, I'm just talking to a few people around football. They can't understand why, whatever about the kind of arguments about the horse trading or the contractual demands, why when the domestic bubbles have obviously worked because there's been low cases compared to society at large, why put those bubbles at risk by taking players out of them and sending them all over the world, across borders, into different situations? And like, in some cases, whatever about playing 3 games in a week, some countries have had to actually cross 3 different borders and play in three different countries in that time, which is just, again, it just seems ludicrous in the current circumstances.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's ridiculous, isn't it? And I suppose we've got to look at it in practical terms. It's no surprise, to follow up your earlier point, Dom, that Jurgen Klopp is leading the argument for five substitutes. I think it was 15 managers agreed when they met this week. In practical terms, how does he cope and how do Liverpool cope?
They lean on players like Reece Williams at centre-back.
But he's injured, isn't he?
Well, he had a very minor stiff hip, apparently, which strikes me that that probably isn't going to be an issue that would take him out of the weekend. Look, I might be proved wrong in what remains of the week. Curtis Jones was feeling his back as well, AD Boothroyd suggested. But again, he should be fine. These are minor knocks, that they're precautionary withdrawals or knocks and bruises that you'd get run-of-the-mill in every competitive fixture, I guess. And you have to lean on that. You have to lean on your squad. You have to make... I mean, we're not seriously saying that Liverpool lack a depth of quality to their squad, are we? We know that they have good quality. They can rest players for Atalanta in midweek potentially. I mean, they've done so well so far in their Champions League group that fixture is one where the fringe players presumably get a run out. They can target the Leicester City game as the priority. And you get by. Every club is doing it. I mean, a sense of pragmatism has to kick in if we're going to get through this season. It's afflicting. I mean, you only have to look at the injury table. Liverpool are up there, yeah, but there are other clubs with less resources who have also got large injury lists at this stage of the season. It's across the board. It's up and down the pyramid, and we just have to get through it in the way that, you know, we have to get through everyday life at the moment.
You need leaders in this sort of circumstance, Migs. What's the impact, you think, of the probable absence of Jordan Henderson against Leicester? And also, someone like Andy Robertson, who is, you know, a pivotal figure in many ways now, because he's probably their only fit defender, first-choice defender at the moment. You know, he's coming back from Israel, where he played with Scotland. He played another 90 minutes when he wasn't 100%.
Yeah, again, it's just remarkable. I mean, on one side, I suppose, it's the players' insistence about playing as well. I mean, as Southgate said on Tuesday, most of them want their international caps and to break centuries and reach landmarks and all that. But still, yeah, it feels unnecessary. I mean, you're right. I suppose in situations like this and the way we've seen in kind of title seasons of the past, and there is an element of digging in, and just it's about kind of a certain level of standards reached, even if you can't, if you don't have the players to be in your best form. I think that's probably what Liverpool will miss most with Henderson if he can't make it on Saturday. And it's why you feel a player like Robertson is specifically necessary in a situation like this, given that that's what he excels at. It's going to, well, I mean, whatever about kind of Liverpool's mental resilience, though, it's going to really test Klopp's almost creativity with what he does with that 11 and how he kind of, you know, balances out weaknesses in one area, what he does with some of his players. I mean, you know, his first 11 could be as interesting as some of the game.
I don't know about waiting for Godot, but we're certainly waiting for Thiago, aren't we? Is there some unease that it seems to have taken quite a while to get him back?
I guess you go with what the medical departments are telling you. Maybe I don't know whether Thiago is somebody that has to play when he's only 100%. There are players out there who like that, who don't feel as if they want to risk putting their bodies through competitive football if they're not 100%. Thiago may be like that. I don't know. But I think you just have to, as first team managers, they have to take advice on board from their sports scientists and medical departments. And you play players when they are ready and they're not in their red zones. They're not risking further injury or further mishap. Players also take time to adapt. I mean, we're all blown away by the flashes of pedigree and quality that we saw from Thiago when he came into English football. But sometimes, you know, it does take them time to adjust to the sort of constant aggressive nature of Premier League football. That's the reality. You can go back 20 years. That was the same, still the case then. And it's probably more acute now when the games are coming so thick and fast. So I just have to say a bit of patience, because we all know that the bloke is an absolutely unbelievable footballer. And in time, he will impose himself at Liverpool and on the Premier League and become one of the stellar performers in this division.
Just looking at his stats, actually, there's only been, in his time at Bayern, there was only one season where he played at least 30 league games, and his average across seven seasons was 21 appearances, which would point to what Dom is saying, maybe. I mean, he's a thoroughbred in that sense, isn't he?
Certainly is. There'll be a lot of, you know, inevitable attention on Brendan Rodgers when he returns to Anfield on Sunday. Let's try and put him into a bit of perspective, can we? Dom, do you think he's been unfairly judged on pretty outdated stereotypes?
No, I think Brendan Rodgers gets a lot of praise, quite rightly, for everything he's done in his career. I think people probably look back fondly on that 2013-14 campaign at Liverpool and how close they came. Okay, there was a stumble at the end, you know, literal and figurative as well. But you know, that the Liverpool team now is much better than that Liverpool team then. And okay, Luis Suarez, Raheem Sterling, Daniel Sturridge, that what a wonderful front line that was, and Steven Gerrard's drive in midfield. It was great to watch, but there were equally clear deficiencies to that team, not least the goalkeeper and the centre backs potentially. So it was actually a really, really fantastic achievement to get Liverpool so tantalisingly close going into the last round of fixtures of the season. And then that subsequently, when it fell away, maybe when a bit of realism kicked in and it was time for a change, yeah, there were issues around it was the Real Madrid fixture, wasn't it? And the team put out in the Champions League. And maybe his reputation suffered a bit around that point. But he revived his reputation at Celtic, and he's done absolutely brilliantly at Leicester City. We shouldn't. Our view of Brendan Rodgers should not be coloured by what happened post-lockdown with Leicester City, because, again, that was an artificial situation, of tournament football in a squad that maybe at the time wasn't geared up to that. Just wasn't really able to compete with that number of games in that short length of time. So they fell away after a brilliant first two thirds of the season. The way they started this just is a better indication of how good they are and how good the coaching is and the impact he makes. I think he's done an absolutely brilliant job. I wrote a piece quite recently on sort of the rise of the re-rise of the British manager in the English game, and Brendan Rodgers is right up there as elite level. I mean, elite level British manager performing in England in the Premier League, and he deserves all the plaudits because he's done a wonderful job at Leicester.
Just even yes. In relation to that, the drop off in Project Restart. I mean, I think what's very impressive is that even allowing for that, and even the way it ended up, I think he still outperformed what Leicester should have been expected to achieve last season. I mean, finishing fifth in a league with a big six over the last few years was usually impressive. And I think from a wider perspective, Rodgers is also someone, he's almost proof that basically what you say will look very different and be perceived very different depending on whether you're winning or losing. Because, I mean, obviously, when you reference stereotypes, this ultimately comes down to Rodgers. It's, I suppose, comments he's made in the past and, you know, a certain kind of Brentian appearance. But when you're winning games, something that would otherwise sound cringe can often seem like great insight. But the one thing I would say, it feels like he has reined that in, and also he's maybe reined in some of his own, I don't want to say flaws as a manager, but I mean, Dom referenced there about, you know, that defence, and I mean, obviously there was a huge quality gap between Liverpool's defence and Liverpool's attack that season, but it's also interesting how his Leicester team, I mean, they do have a better backline than that Liverpool, but also they just seem so much more solidly structured in general, and it's something that Rodgers himself has worked on.
Yeah, I spoke to Brendan about his public image, and I said, look, did you learn anything from the whole Liverpool experience and the whole David Brent thing? And he said, look, yeah. And he was very wry, actually. He basically said, look, I've learned to listen more and to say less. So I quite like that about him. There's a bit of self-deprecation there.
Did he watch The Office?
I don't know. Didn't ask him, actually. I'm not a very good journalist, as you well know.
One of you knows who David Brent actually is. I've got no idea.
Oh, blimey. But what about the nature of the team that he's building at Leicester?
Well, look, it
plays to its quality in attack in Jamie Vardy, and I mean, he does seem to just go on and maintain his level in a remarkable way, and maintain his pace, moreover, which is staggering given that, you know, time is ticking for Jamie Vardy. But I just love the way that that Brendan Rodgers has managed to get Leicester playing in this way with injuries, actually having taken away and outgoing transfers having potentially been very, very disruptive, and yet he's found a way of adapting and getting players to play specific roles. So, you know, Ndidi, who was, we'll all accept, I imagine, that is such a key player in that Leicester team and has been there for the last few years. In his absence, Mondi has come in and done a great job. You know, the back, when you're losing Soyuncu and yet you've got Fofana come in and just adapt to English football, a young kid plucked out of Saint-Etienne who really, from his early showings, would suggest that Arsenal maybe targeted the wrong centre-half at Saint-Etienne. And the way that he's getting the best out of fringe players from other clubs, the Turkish winger is it Under from Roma, who's playing great cameos off the bench and just looks as if he's hungry, looks as if he's eager to get his career back on track and demonstrate the pedigree and quality that he has. These are all guys that are being revitalised by playing in a Brendan Rodgers team, by playing in a team that's able to recover from, you know, a humiliating home defeat to West Ham United and just go on this winning run and combine that with Europa League football as well. There's so much to admire about what they're doing, and it may not last. It may not be prolonged. I don't think it will be the same as it was in 2015-16. But it's great fun to watch, and I'm sure that it's got the Leicester supporters in absentia in absolute raptures.
Yeah, I think it's significant, you know, drawing the whole Rodgers debate to a close, that his players, both past and present, speak really highly of him. Miggs, what about Manchester City? They return at Spurs on Saturday. It seems really strange to realise that, like Man United, they're in the bottom half of the table.
Yeah, and now as we approach kind of, well, we're about a quarter of the way into the season now. And it does point to something not being fully right at City. It's hard to get away from, and it's something that's come up a fair bit this season, the wider view that Guardiola's never been in this situation before. He's never gone so far with any one club. And really the challenge now is, I mean, because it does feel the kind of the cycle of that, of his great City team of 2018, 2019 has now moved on. And we're in the process, it's transition between one team and another. We've never seen Guardiola build another title winning team. In fact, it's something that's actually been done very few times in the history of English football. I think only 6 or 7 managers have done it. Most recently, of course, Wenger and Ferguson did it about 3 or 4 times. But it's a difficult challenge. And it does, I mean, it also feeds into some of the wider debates about Guardiola. I mean, I think everyone would by now accept he's, you know, a genius, a visionary, one of the great managers. But what makes him great could also be what makes it difficult for him in this situation, which is that intensity is hard for players to put up with for that long without drastically changing the personnel. And I think, and it's something that strikes with City right now, and they play in bursts. But the last time I saw them live was against West Ham, a 1-1 draw. And, like, I mean, they just looked so off what you'd expect the best of a Man City team or a best of a Pep Guardiola team to be, which is a size that really don't give you an inch and just relentless about everything they do. And it just feels a general flatness at the moment. And that game is almost, it is a little bit of a kind of a put your cards on the table game, in that, you know, Spurs have obviously had a good run, but beating City would really propel them and kind of prove this there could be something long-term about this. While City, they can't really afford another slip. I mean, I suppose a draw away to Spurs wouldn't be too bad, but it would still leave them in pretty bad shape in the table, as you mentioned. And it's going to be instructive to see which way it goes.
In the element of transition, Dom, obviously the focus will be on some of the younger players. Phil Foden will go back to City, you know, presumably bouncing after doing well with England. Ferran Torres, similarly, you know, after getting his hat-trick in that 6-0 win over Germany. I suppose the key question is, will Guardiola trust them?
Yeah, well, maybe he has to increasingly, as we've just been talking about, the need to juggle your options and to make use of the entirety of your squad. I mean, he's shown he's increasingly trusting of Foden, and quite right too, because he's a very, very, very good player. And Torres, I imagine the relatively fleeting appearances we've seen from him, and he has actually featured quite a lot for City in bits and bobs, but that's an adaptation, that's a new country, that's a new league, that's a chance to break a player into new surroundings. We have to be a bit careful to write City off. They've lost one game all season. I mean, we've been saying all year that how wildly unpredictable the Premier League is. Well, City and Chelsea, two teams there that have lost once. Chelsea were knocked out of the League Cup on penalties, but that's once in all competitions, effectively, for both of them in 90 minutes. And okay, they've drawn too many games. They'll both say that, City in particular. City have got a game in hand as well. Let's not get carried away here. This league has been disrupted so far by lots of different factors, not least international windows up to this point. Now you've got a run between, an intense run between mid-November and March time, where leagues will effectively be decided, and we'll find out who the also-rans are and who are the real contenders. And I don't think any of us is going to sit here and say that City aren't going to be in contention, that they this is a real opportunity for them to impose themselves back on the division. Spurs will go into this fixture exactly the same way and say, you know, this is our opportunity, as Mick says, you know, chance to demonstrate just how good we are. But we shouldn't be writing these guys off yet. They're both absolutely crammed full of quality, and that quality will tell over the months to come.
Yeah. Before we go into Spurs, Migs, permit me the indulgence. Can we do a little bit of we wind our way down memory lane? Mario Balotelli, City legend. How entertaining would it be for him to turn up at Barnsley?
Well, yeah, I think as a few people have mentioned, it was the sort of thing you would have thought you would have, you know, maybe seen on one of these piss take websites around 2012. I mean, we just added kind of another curious episode to Balotelli's career, could be quite a fun episode. I think it would be good to see him back in English football again. Have to say,
I'm still getting my head around the fact that Valerian Ismail is the Barnsley manager, a player whose playing career in English football consisted of being a record signing at Crystal Palace in 1997 and being absolutely humiliated by Carl Leburn in a home derby against Wimbledon. I mean, Carl Leburn trampled all over him that night, and his career never recovered. He did a brilliant job at LASK in Austria for a while last season. Took them to those games with Manchester United, but it was a surprise to see him appointed. And actually wish him well, because he's a lovely, lovely bloke. I spoke to him last season. He's a great guy.
Good to see the scars have healed.
never.
What about Jose Mourinho? He's been in his most sarcastic mood this week, which is unlikely to be improved by having lost Doherty to COVID. What about Harry Kane? Is there a real chance that he's being overplayed here? I think he's had the most minutes of any Premier League player, something like, I think it's 1,456 minutes. Again, is he his own worst enemy, Kane? He wants to play.
I'd say a little bit, yeah. And when Sergei mentioned that on Tuesday about players wanting to break all these landmarks and they really want to play for their country, you couldn't really have a bigger example of that than Kane himself. And I suppose, you know, wanting to play all the time ultimately ties into wanting to score all the time. He's played more minutes than anyone in the Premier League this season, or certainly in the Spurs team. I might have that slightly wrong. But, I mean, on the other side of it, I suppose, there's the fact that he's been in incredible form and is wanting to sustain that and all. But the way you sustain that is really with kind of ensuring you're not anyway burnt out. And I suppose the hope is that he manages this well over the next while.
Mm. What about the management of Harry Winks, Dom? Again, came on as substitute for England against Iceland. Seems to be more comfortable at international level than club level. Will he get his chance?
That's a good question. He never really struck me as a likely regular starter under Mourinho, certainly the old style Mourinho. There was a period last season where he seemed to be imposing himself, if I recall correctly, and he felt more integral. But you're right, he's a player that Gareth Southgate has always cherished. He spoke of him even when Winks was absent through injury. He was always the player that he wanted to incorporate into his midfield as a sort of metronomic passer, somebody that can with a scuttling presence, you know, who can distribute the ball cleverly and safely in a more possession based England game plan. And he was earmarked very, very early on in Southgate's England tenure as being a key performer to achieve that. I suspect that in time he probably will establish himself again or re-establish himself at international level as somebody that Southgate completely relies on, possibly in a major tournament more than a qualifying campaign, when England desperately need to protect the ball and keep the ball against better quality opponents in a major finals. But at Spurs, there's probably greater competition in that position for him, and players that Mourinho might think maybe fit the bill, fit more his idea of how he wants to be playing the football. But the sheer number of games that Spurs are going to play this season, he still will get a load of matches for them. I mean, that is the reality. So if he goes, he'll probably still play 40 games this season, which is a good haul, and will probably ensure that if he stays clear of injury, that he still goes into a summer tournament relatively fresh.
Yeah, what about Arsenal, Migs? You know, they didn't have the best of international breaks. They lost Elneny to COVID just when he was reclaiming his place and his influence. You had the distraction of Willian and his Dubai trip, which didn't seem all that fantastically sensible. Is that 3-year pension plan contract looking like a great investment at the moment?
it's not just the trickiest international break, it's the build-up to it as well, given that 3-0 defeat to Villa. And it is hard to get any sort of read on Arsenal at the minute, given, I mean, look at the, I mean, whatever about these sort of variables, if you want to be kind about it, or factors are kind of complicating life for Arteta. There was the way they go from that win against Manchester United was so resolute and kind of indicated, you know, the tactical intelligence of Arteta, to then a week later, whatever happened against Aston Villa. it was almost impossible to square one with the other. It's possible we expect too much of Arteta himself, given this is so early into his managerial career. But then, of course, the other side of that is, when you're at a club like this, these are the demands. You can only cut slack for a certain amount. I mean, of course, there are questions about the exact quality of that squad, although he has made a lot of signings he's wanted in the last one. I think with Arteta and Arsenal, you would have expected them to be maybe a bit far ahead of where they are right now. And he's entering, I think, what is going to be a challenging period, especially because, I mean, whatever about this situation being tricky for the whole league and a kind of a slog of games or a grind, as you said, that they've never faced before. I mean, most managers have some experience of getting through a Christmas schedule and managing it in that way. Whereas, I mean, Arteta obviously came in just before Christmas last year, but this is his first real. His first real experience of something this prolonged and something this much of a slog, and how he navigates that is just another little challenge for him to pass.
The Willian transfer absolutely fascinates me. I mean, because there was a real sense of triumphalism when they prized him from Chelsea, so to speak, over the summer. Chelsea had hoped to give him a 2-year contract, or, you know, 1 year with another option, and yet here we go. He'd always wanted a 3-year deal. He got one from Arsenal, and I think it was a Fulham game right on the opening weekend where he played very, very well, and he just had to glance at Arsenal Twitter, and it was very much, wow, what a coup we've pulled off here. This is incredible. This is the player in his prime that won so many trophies in his time at Chelsea. But I'm just amazed. I'm amazed that Chelsea tried that hard to keep him. Imagine if he was still at Chelsea now on a on a, say, a two-year deal, where would he fit? Where would he be in that team? Where would he be close to the first 11? Nowhere near. He'd be a fringe player and a disaffected senior fringe player at best. And B, I'm not sure if anyone who'd watched his performances over the last 18 months, that yes, there were flashes of brilliance occasionally at Chelsea, but it was never real consistency to it. He would blow very hot and cold, and it just seems an incredible risk to give him 3 years on a considerable wage at Arsenal. Look, he may prove me wrong. He may have a revival. It may just be an adjustment period at a new club. But I had expected him to make more of an impact to justify the fanfare that was granted that signing in the first couple of months of the season.
Well, just on that as well, it's also surprising now, from what everyone says at Arsenal and around Arsenal as well, is that this was a signing that Arteta himself pushed for and was very happy with, which is in itself, given what you would have thought about what he wants to do with the profile of the team, was in itself surprising. I've always liked Willian, but he's a very distinctive player when he does start surging forward, and obviously there's that set piece he has, but he has always blown hot and cold as well. And you'd always think that he should have scored more than his returns have been when he has that kind of quality.
His best season at Chelsea was undoubtedly the season where everybody else's performances dipped horrendously in that 15-16 season. And he did score a lot of goals that season. And yeah, he's a good player, but he's a player that I'd suggest is possibly past his prime.
Talking of running hot and cold, Migs, Arsenal are at Leeds on Sunday. Is it time for the real Bielsa team to stand up?
I have to say, I think this is going to be reality, which is going to be, I mean, Bielsa, in terms of how he plays, obviously that'll always be consistent, but because of the nature of this Leeds squad in this Premier League, and I suppose especially in a season like this, I think we're going to see more so than any other team in the league, almost wild swings between results and performances. And I mean, it was something almost you thought coming into the season where it was almost as difficult. I think Leeds are one of the most difficult teams to predict. And had someone told you they'd be relegated or they'd finish just outside the top six, it would have been easy to find either situation equally believable. And I think that's going to be the nature of the campaign. The real Leeds is going to be this wildly inconsistent but very often entertaining team. And actually, this game is probably the hardest to predict this weekend.
In that vein, Manchester United, would it be typical of them to struggle against West Brom? And because you always get the impression, don't you, that they're one setback away from a renewed crisis.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, on recent form, yes, it's eminently predictable that this will be a slog of a performance against a team that sits deep and maybe a team that they can't play on the counter attack against. You'd expect them to find a way through eventually. I mean, West Brom have, you know, they've not won yet this season. I think they've only got a point on the road so far, and some of their performances have left a lot to be desired. So they are there. It's an opportunity for United, but yeah, they know what to expect. They're gonna have to break them down. So they're gonna need Fernandes at his creative best. They're gonna need width. They're gonna need pace. They're gonna need to really inflict wounds on West Brom early, an early goal, and they'll be fine, and getting that first home win of the season towards the end of November, and Manchester United still haven't won a home game. It does sort of show the weird nature of the Premier League this season.
It is. One of the things we spoke about actually earlier in the week was the lack of managerial casualties in the Premier League, which might be a reflection of the season or the nature of the season. What about Slaven Bilic, Migs? What are his job prospects, do you think?
It's hard to say, really. I mean, he's always been an interesting man. And just when Dom was mentioning there about the team that Manchester United will play this season, I was actually kind of thinking how Bilic will set up, given obviously West Brom's defence has been one of the most porous this season. But, I mean, if you go back to his best season at West Ham in 15, that, which was actually that Leicester season, 15-16, Bilic has always been a manager in that his teams have almost played almost to the level of the side they come up against. In that sometimes when they play very bad sides, they can actually look very bad. Where when they play quite good sides, they can react well. And it almost feels like he's a manager who works at his best in adapting to the opposition, which I suppose maybe why he's had a bit of a curious career as well. When he was Croatian manager that knocked out England in 2007 for them from going to Euro 2008, you would have thought he was kind of one of the coming managers in Europe, where his career has obviously proved much more inconsistent in that regard. I think maybe there was a sense that not the West Brom got promoted ahead of time, but he did a relatively good job getting them back up, which is maybe why this season should be forgiven with him. But I mean, because when they came up, I mean, I think they're pretty much almost everyone had them to go down in this season's predictions, didn't they?
They certainly did.
I think there's a frustration there with incoming transfers, though, isn't there? There's clearly a bit of friction there within the hierarchy between Bilic and the ownership, and whether he was allowed to make the signings that he wanted in the summer, and maybe the timing of them. I know, obviously, Grant was a player that he was desperate to get in, and he did eventually arrive, but it was quite late on, and that maybe left a bit of an imbalance in the squad through the opening weeks, when they did actually have some games that you look back on and think, well, they might have actually been opportunities, and things like Burnley at home and Fulham away, Brighton away, that they are probably the games that they needed to get results in. But look at you're right, against Chelsea. Remember that first half against Chelsea at the Hawthorns? Absolutely superb. And they played well against Tottenham in their most recent fixture. And it was the narrow, narrow late defeat that was inflicted upon them, inevitably by Kane. But they are hopefully moving in the right direction. And I agree with Migs. I think it'll be insanely unfair, really, for Bilic to lose his job, because what he did last season alone was fantastic.
Yeah, speaking of Chelsea, they're at Newcastle in Saturday's lunchtime game. Frank Lampard has terrific faith in Mason Mount. Watching him play for England last night, you can understand why. But he's still quite a callow player, isn't he? Will he need protecting, do you think, as the season progresses?
Well, yeah, Mason Mount won't be able to play 75 games or whatever it is. I mean, at some point he'll come out of the firing line. But he has occasionally rested him, Lampard. I mean, he hasn't always. I know the impression is that he's the favourite for club and country, but you know, there have been times when Chelsea have had a full complement of midfielders, and Lampard has wanted to freshen things up. Yeah, it has been Mason Mount that set out. But the thing is, he's so key to them in terms of their press, their energy, their dynamism through midfield. I think in the absence of Kai Havertz through COVID, I don't think he'll be around this weekend, the absence of Pulisic on the left, you probably do need his energy in that Chelsea midfield at the moment, especially if Lampard's going to pursue the 4-3-3 with Conte as the most defensive lying midfielder. So Mount has to play, and then you can bring in people like Kovacic. You can ask Ziyech to do the running off the right, and you can get your fullbacks attacking and providing some width, and it just looks a really good functioning Chelsea team all of a sudden. It's funny how a little tweak of the formation has made them look far more at home. But Mount is key to that. Mount is a key player. And for the big matches, for the key matches in Chelsea's season, and I'd suggest that Newcastle more than Rennes in midweek is the bigger game of those two, given Chelsea's start to their Champions League group, that he'd want Mason Mount involved and starting.
There's a reason managers love him, isn't there?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
He offers discipline, basically.
What do you make of Newcastle, Migs? Discipline is not really a word I would tend to use about that football club.
No, although, strangely, actually, it's probably, how to put this, it's one of the few, maybe, positives you'd say about Bruce's approach, in that they're not very nice to watch. They can often be a slog, but that is because, I suppose, the one thing you are guaranteed with Newcastle is that they probably offer as much defensive order as the circumstances allow. Of course. And it's interesting, that doesn't really reflect maybe what goes on behind the scenes at the club, or its general direction and how they kind of veer from one thing to the next. But, yeah, I mean, discipline is one of the traits that the actual football team has.
They are the most consistent club in the country, though, aren't they?
Yeah,
in terms of their results, they follow a sequence every time. Is it one loss drawn all the way through or something like that? It's followed that sequence. I think they have to draw. Against Chelsea this week, and then they beat Crystal Palace in the next game when they maintained that particular sequence, I think.
Great stat. It's a great stat.
Yeah. That is very good, yeah.
Because I must admit, one of the things I really do miss about the lack of crowds is, you know, I always used to really enjoy going to St James's Park. I know it's cliched, but the atmosphere is fantastic. Let's look at the broader issue of a return of crowds, if we could. Do you think there's a danger that clubs will want to introduce it before it's prudent? I suppose, is it best to do it in stages? Where and when should it all happen, do you think?
Well, it's going to have to be staged, isn't it? Because they won't be able to just go from, you know, literally 0 to 100, 0% fans to 100% fans. It's going to have to be some sort of stagger steps, as much to kind of, because, I mean, there are some optimistic appraisals that we might have relative normality in society by April. But even allowing for that, there's obviously going to be a lot of measures in place that clubs will have to adapt to. And it does feel like this is going to be quite a staggered process to get fans back. Just as a little bit of a tangent, actually, it's something that struck you mentioned there. When I was going into Wembley last night, I was talking to Sammy Mockbell about this, that, and I suppose this is relevant to his club like Newcastle as well, that it does feel, I mean, while it's obviously a privilege for journalists to go to games, that's without question, it's something that's become more and more apparent as the situation has gone on, that games feel much less of an event without crowds. And there is obviously much less difference between actually watching it on TV and watching in the stadium, because, you know, one of the many virtues of a crowd there is just, even from a media perspective, is A, the spectacle creates, but B, also in allowing a much better barometer for the mood of a club. And also, I suppose, and maybe this feeds into kind of why we haven't seen any managerial casualties as well, in how fans and how the general support base reacts to what is going on. Maybe there's a few people in football that that don't particularly miss that. But yeah, I mean, back to the wider question, it does feel like this is going to be something that'll involve a few stagger steps and a little bit of trial, and hopefully not too much error.
It's going to be really interesting, isn't it? I mean, none of us is going to sit here and say we don't want fans back in stadium, because we're all missing supporters so much, and it does take away so much from the spectacle, They're not, they're unreal situations watching games behind closed doors. They're horrible, actually. They're not fun in the slightest, really. But actually, you know, if you're one of the four clubs have gone to Old Trafford this season and haven't lost. So that means there'll be, 15 more teams have got to go to Old Trafford. And if 10 of those are going to face a crammed Old Trafford, an Old Trafford that's full of fans, then that's warped the competition a bit, to be honest. I mean, that's not the same as Crystal Palace or Tottenham Hotspur or Arsenal going and winning at Old Trafford this season. That's a completely different ball game. So it does. It's another element. I mean, I'm not saying that we should go through this season without fans, because that is unthinkable, and we don't want to have to contemplate that. But it isn't. It's going to be the next level of unpredictability in this division, and this mad division that the Premier League has become.
Strange times. Let's try and pull all this together if we could. Our thoughts for the day. Dom, can you start, please?
Well, I don't know if it counts as a thought for the day, but it is. I wanted to wish someone the best of luck, actually, for the weekend. Liam Rossignol is going to be taking charge, effectively, of Derby County following the dismissal of Philip Cocu. They play at Bristol City on Saturday. And I know all the attention has been drawn towards Wayne Rooney, and the four coaching staff that are overseeing duties on a sort of caretaker basis at Derby County for the foreseeable future. But I think it is actually Liam Rossignol who is the most qualified coach on that staff. And he's always envisaged, and this is the fulfilment of a dream for Liam, who started off, you know, working with his dad Leroy and watching his dad Leroy coach at Gloucester City and Bristol City and places like that when he was a kid when he was, and he's always envisaged being a manager one day. And Ashton Gate, the club where it all started for him as a player, this Saturday, he will be in charge of a first team and putting out a side. And I just think that's a great story, and I wish him all the best in it.
Yeah, good luck to him. Good luck. Migs.
I mean, this it very much comes down to almost a thought experiment, as much as a thought. But something, I mean, the headlines the week have thrown up is we might have to start imagining football without heading at some point. I mean, and obviously there's a much more serious issue there, given, you know, this almost crisis of dementia among so many older players. But it does feel like it's something the games have to kind of think about. And, you know, and almost on a more trivial level, but very significant to the future of the sport, I was wondering how much it would actually change football. And I actually think much less so than even 10 years ago, because stats of headed goals have actually fallen. And I mean, I suppose if you go back to the influence of a coach like Guardiola and the way the game has evolved, the pressing and all that since, it does feel like heading is much less a part of the game. And it's a much more kind of technique-based, ground-based game now. But it is something we may have to confront relatively soon. I mean, obviously the research is inconclusive for the moment, but it does feel like an issue that's kind of bubbling away in the background and could well come to the fore fairly soon. The Telegraph did that study this week, and yeah, I think it is very much something to think about.
Yeah, I suppose I'll get one thing straight before I begin. Football, despite all its problems, is a great place in which to work. And now I think it's enriched my life, both personally and professionally. I'm sure, you know, the guys would say the same thing. Our job, though, is to point out its faults as well as its attractions. Now, I'll admit I was really surprised and quite concerned to learn this week that a Champions League club, Midtjylland, linked to Brentford and their enlightened recruitment programme, were looking to employ a video scout. Great chance for someone, I hear you say. The problem is that the role is voluntary and unpaid. Now, I know ambition is exploited in other industries. The media has far too many unpaid internships for my liking. But football has the money to be better than that. That video scout could save them millions. Give him a break, or her a break. What do you think? Please let me know. In the meantime, thanks to Dom and Miguel, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.